Curtis was not the real name of the jeweler in Dallas. Curtis worked fine when corresponding with Ricky in rehab, but the real name was Van Gates. Mr. Gates was 58 years old, on the surface happily married, the father of three and the grandfather of two, and he and his wife owned six jewelry stores in the Dallas area, all located in malls. On paper, they had $2 million, and they'd made it themselves. They had a nice new home in Highland Park, with separate bedrooms at opposite ends. They met in the kitchen for coffee and in the den for TV and grandkids. Mr. Gates ventured from the closet now and then, always with excruciating caution. No one had a clue. His correspondence with Ricky was his first attempt at finding love through the want ads, and so far he'd been thrilled with the results. He rented a small box in a post office near one of the malls and used the name Curtis V. Gates. The lavender envelope was addressed to Curtis Gates, and as he sat in his car and carefully opened it, he at first had no clue anything was wrong. Just another sweet letter from his beloved Ricky. Lightning hit, though, with the first words. "Dear Van Gates, the party's over, pal. My name ain't Ricky, and you're not Curtis. I'm not a gay boy looking for love. You, however, have an awful secret, which I'm sure you want to keep. I want to help. Here's the deal. Wire $100,000 to Geneva Trust Bank, Nassau, Bahamas, account number 144-DXN-9593 for Boomer Realty Limited, routing number 392844-22. Do so immediately. This is not a joke. It's a scam, and you've been hooked. If the money is not received within 10 days, I will send to your wife, Ms. Glenda Gates, a little packet filled with copies of all letters, photos, etc. Wire the money, and I'll simply go away. Love, Ricky." With time, Van found the Dallas I-635 loop, and before long he was on the I-820 loop around Fort Worth, then back to Dallas, driving at exactly 55 in the right-hand lane, oblivious to the traffic stacked up behind him. If crying would help, then he certainly would have had a good one. He had no qualms about weeping, especially in the privacy of his Jaguar. But he was too angry to cry, too bitter to be wounded, and he was too frightened to waste time yearning for someone who did not exist. Action was needed, quick, decisive, secretive. Heartache, though, overcame him, and he finally pulled onto the shoulder and parked with the engine running. All those wonderful dreams of Ricky, those countless hours staring at his handsome face with his crooked little smile and reading his letters, sad, funny, desperate, hopeful. How could so many emotions be conveyed with the written word? He'd practically memorized the letters. And he was just a boy, so young and virile, yet lonely and in need of mature companionship. The Ricky he'd come to love needed the loving embrace of an older man, and Curtis Stroke Van had been making plans for months. The ploy of a diamond show in Orlando while his wife was in El Paso at her sister's. He'd sweated the details and left no tracks. He did finally cry. Poor Van shed tears without shame or embarrassment. No one could see him. The other cars were flying past at 80 miles per hour. He vowed revenge, like any jilted lover. He'd track down this beast, this monster, who'd posed as Ricky and broken his heart. When the sobbing began to subside, he thought of his wife and family, and that helped greatly in drying up the tears. She'd get all six stores and the $2 million, and the new house with separate bedrooms, and he would get nothing but ridicule and scorn and gossip in a town that loved it so. His children would follow the money, and for the rest of their lives, his grandchildren would hear the whispers about their grandfather. Back in the right lane at 55, back through Mesquite for the second time, reading the letter again as 18-wheelers roared past. There was no one to call, no banker he could trust to check out the account in the Bahamas, no lawyer to run to for advice, no friend to hear his sorry tale. For a man who'd carefully lived a double life, the money would not be insurmountable. His wife watched every dime, both at home and at the stores, and for that reason Van had long since mastered the scheme of hiding money. He did it with gems, rubies, and pearls, and sometimes small diamonds he placed aside and later sold to other dealers for cash. It was common in the business. He had boxes of cash, shoeboxes neatly stacked in a fireproof safe in a mini-storage out in Plano, post-divorce cash, cash for the afterlife, when he and Ricky would sail the world and spend it all in one endless voyage.
"Son of a bitch!"
he said through gritted teeth, and again and again. Why not write this con man and plead poverty, or threaten to expose his little extortion scheme? Why not fight back? Because the son of a bitch knew exactly what he was doing. He'd track Van well enough to learn his real name and the name of his wife. He knew Van had the money. He pulled into his driveway, and there was Glenda sweeping the sidewalk.
"Where have you been, honey?"
she asked pleasantly.
"Running errands," he said with a smile.
"Took a long time," she said, still sweeping.
He was so sick of it. She timed his movements. For 30 years he'd been under her thumb, with a stopwatch clicking in the palm of her hand.
He pecked her on the cheek out of habit, then went to the basement where he locked a door and began to cry again. The home was his prison. With a mortgage of $7,800 a month, it certainly felt like it. She was the guard, the keeper of the keys. His sole means of escape had just collapsed, replaced by a cold-blooded extortionist.